Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Nun Chet Amud Bet on the last line. Amar Rav, Ana Havai b'minyono d'bei Rabbi, u'minai didi manu b'reisha. So Rav says, and we know that Rav is a Talmud of Rabbi. He is close with his uncle Rabbi Chia, who is also a Talmud of Rabbi. And we know from the Edut of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish that they remember in the early years that Rav used to sit in the front row in Rabbi's shir when they were in the back row. Eventually, the Gemara in Yoma tells us that the Bnei Rabbi Chia chased Rav to Bavel, and Rav ends up in Bavel becoming the Gadol Hador in Bavel. But in the early years, he lives in Eretz Yisrael, and he is a part of the shir Beit Din of Rabbi. And so Rav says over here, I was amongst those that were there, and Rabbi was mitakein that which was mentioned here in the Mishnah. The Rabbi said with regards to the Sikri cone that all you had to do after 12 months was buy it from the Sikri cone and then pay a quarter to the Baalim and you were done. You didn't have to give first right of refusal to the Baalim that expired after 12 months. So Rav says, I was a member of that Beit Din and they began from me first. As Rashi notes over here, when it comes to the taking of a quorum and asking what the decision is of the Beit Din, with regards to Dinei Nefashot, we have Lo Taneh Al Riv, the Gemara Darshan, because the way it's spelled, Lo Taneh Al Rav, that you don't answer from the Great One, and that means that we go from the lowest on the totem pole to the highest on the totem pole, the reason not being that you can't argue on the Gadol by the court, but simply because his influence is great. And so we don't want him stating his opinion first, because if he states his opinion first, it will influence the other parties in the Beit Din. So therefore we start from the lowest on the totem pole and move upwards so that they're not influenced by those that are greater than them. Now that's true with regards to Dinei Nefashot. That is not true with regards to Dinei Mimonot. The reason being that by Dinei Nefashot, we always try to do everything we can in our power to do the schut of the defendant here. So that's not true by Dinei Mamonot. It is true by Dinei Nefashot, which is the Gemara's question now. Now, Rashi notes over here, Uminai Didi Manu Beresha. Rashi brings two interpretations. He says, one is, V'hu Haya Benoni, Lo Minak Dolim V'lo Minak Tanim. They started from me. He wasn't one of the top guys there. He wasn't the bottom. He was in the middle somewhere. V'ani Shamati Shekatan Shebem Haya. Rashi says, I myself heard that he was the youngest or the on the lowest on the totem pole there, which would make sense because they began from him. Vanantanan, don't we have a Mishnah? Dine mimonot, v'ate arot, v'atum ot, matchilim min agadol. Then when it comes to monetary matters or iser v'heter, then we begin the quorum and the decision process from the gadol shebeit din, not the lowest on the totem pole. V'dine nefashot, matchilim min atzad. By Dinei Nefashot, we begin from the side, which means from the Ktanim and not from the Gdolim, based on the way that they sat in a semicircle. Starting from the side would indicate that you're starting from the people on the bottom rung. So over here, we're not dealing with Dinei Nefashot. And so why did they begin from Rav, who's the lowest on the totem pole, or even according to Rashi, the other interpretation in the middle, if this is not a Dinei Nefashot? So Amar Rabba Brei de Rova, Vitema Rabbi Hillel Brei de Rabbi Volos, Shiny Minyono de Bei Rabbi, coming to a decision within the Beit Din of Rabbi was different. De Kulu Minayu Minatzad Abu Matchilin. They, anytime they came to a quorum and they were making a decision, they did it from the side, I mean they did it from the lowest on the totem pole, that it probably has to do with the unique standing of Rabbi. Rabbi has a unique standing in his greatness. And therefore, it's too risky in any decision to have Rabbi speak first because he's so dominant, as we're going to see in a second, both because of his political power as well as his Torah. And therefore, we don't want to start from him because that's going to unduly influence the outcome of the case. And therefore, for everything, including Dinei Mamonot, Iser V'Heter, and of course, Dinei Nefashot, they started from the lowest on the totem pole, the one who was the youngest or the least qualified in the Beit Din. And so Rav is saying about himself that I was in that minyan, and I was the first one, or in the middle, I was picked. It makes sense, because Rav probably was very young at the time, because he leaves to Bavel at a certain point. So this is when Rav is still young, before he becomes great. He's still just in the beginning of his career, And that's why in the Beit Din of Rabbi, he sat towards the Tzad. He wasn't at the top or the front dais in terms of the Beit Din. V'amar Rabbo, Brei D'Rova, V'itema Rabbi Hillel, Brei D'Rabbi Volos. Here again, you have a member on the same individuals, but it's relevant because topically it's also shared here, which is Mimot Moshe v'ad Rabbi, lo matzinu Torah u'gdula b'makom echad. From the time of Moshe Rabbeinu until Rabbi, we did never found the Gadlut Torah, meaning that he was the leading Talmud Chochem in his generation, u'gdula, and also he carried the political power. He was the political leader, whether that's because of his political position or because of his wealth. We never found that, but Makom Echad. Moshe Rabbeinu, in the way that the Rishonim term it, it was both the Melech and the Navi and the Rosh Beit Din, meaning that he had all of those titles in one. Rabbi, in the same way, has both of those titles. Rabbi is from the Shoshelet HaNisi'im. He's a Nasi. And he carries tremendous political power. We know that from his relationship with Antoninus, who was the appointed ruler over Judea, as well as his tremendous wealth, which the Gemara discusses. And of course, in terms of his erudition, we know from the fact that he was the Misader HaMishnah. And that might be actually why Rabbi is the Misader HaMishnah, or the closing of a certain era, because of his standing. That which is equivalent to Moshe Rabbeinu. If Moshe Rabbeinu brought us Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebe'alpeh, Rabbi makes the decision of 8, Lasod Lashem, Eferu Torah Techa, that we have to write down the Torah Shebe'alpeh, and he closes out the period of the Tanaim, as well as the Mishnah. And that's the status of Rabbi because of this unique status. Velo, there was no one else. So now the Gemara is going to propose other people who fit this billing. Hava Yoshua. What about Yoshua? Talmid of Moshe Rabbeinu. Yoshua was both the Melech, I mean he led Bnei Israel, as well as the Torah giant of that generation. It says, Hava Elazar. There was Elazar who was there as well. Elazar Kohen Gadol, who also was of great stature. And therefore he was not alone in his generation. He was not so unique that there was no one near him. Where it says, Ha'ava Elazar. What about Elazar himself? After the passing of Yoshua, you have Elazar, Kohen Gadol. Ha'ava Pinchas. His son Pinchas was there, who also had tremendous standing. Va'ava Pinchas. What about Pinchas himself? Who was both a leader and a Talmud Chacham. We see in Sefer Shoftim that the Am takes advice from Pinchas as what to do, as well as at the end of Sefer Yoshua. So we see Pinchas has both a certain amount of political power, as well as he is seen as a leader in terms of his connection with Hashem, his ability to make decisions for the Am. So the way it says, Abba Zakenim. There are also the Zakenim, which are mentioned at the end of Sefer Yoshua, the Zakenim that Herichu Yamim Achar Yoshua. So Abba Shaul. What about Shaul, who was a Talmud Chacham and a leader, I mean, he became the king of Israel. And we don't know that he was a Talmud Chacham, but it might be evidenced by the fact that Shaul himself got Nivu'ah in the beginning of his reign. So that might be evidence of the fact that he was also a Talmud Chacham in that matter. Hava Shmuel. Shmuel was around at that time. He's the one who anointed Shaul. Va'anach Nafshei. Didn't Shmuel pass away during the lifetime of Shaul? According to the Navi, at the end of his lifetime, according to the Gemara, pretty early on in his reign, Kulu Shnei Kamrinan, saying that his whole lifetime, his whole entire rule, he was the unique and only individual who carried both the title of the Chacham Gadol as well as the political power. That's not true of Shaul, because a part of his lifetime, or the part of his reign, Shmuel is there. Va'alba David. What about David HaMelech? So again here, we have evidence of his political power, his leadership as a king. In terms of his erudition, because of his penning of Tehillim that has a sense of Ruach HaKodesh associated with it, we'd assume that David also has this standing in terms of his connection with Hashem and being a Talmud Chacham. It says, they had at that time Ira Hayairi, who was also a Talmud Chacham, who David was subject to the rulings of, Vanach Nafshe, didn't he pass away? Kulu shnei be'inan. We need all those years, meaning that the entirety of David's reign is not him alone, but there are other individuals. The Gemara here could have brought Achitofel as well, which the Gemara speaks in other places, who was also a Rebbe of David and only passes away at the time of merit of Shalom. So there are other individuals at the time who are Tamidei Chachamim. Hava Shlomo. Again, Shlomo HaMelech, who we know about his political reign and his kingship, but also Hashem speaks to him, Beruach HaKodesh, or Quasi Nevuah, as well as the fact that Shlomo pens part of the canon. Maybe there too, Shlomo HaMelech should be considered someone like this. Hava Shimi Ben Gera. Shimi Ben Gera, who is the Av Beit Din, who is a Talmud Chocham, someone who was given deference. V'hakatle, then in Shlomo HaMelech have him killed. At the beginning of his reign, he has Shimon and Gera killed. Kula Shnei Kamrinan. Again, all of his years we're talking about. And here, for Shlomo HaMelech, Shimon and Gera is there for a certain period of time until he violates the word of Shlomo HaMelech, and then he is put to death. Hava Chizkiyah. What about Chizkiyah HaMelech? Again, we know about his reign, we know about his tzidkut. Seems from the fact that his tefillah, when he was on his deathbed and he turns to speak to Hashem, and his tefillah is heard by Hashem, that he has that type of power or sense of being a Talmud Chacham. Hava Shevna. Shevna was there at that time. He was also a tremendous Talmud Chacham. Was mentioned in the stories there with Chizkiyah and Sancheriv. And so therefore, Chizkiyah is not deemed to be all alone. Va'iktel. Wasn't he killed? Kula Shanei Kamrinan. Again, all the years are said, and again, all of Chizkiyah's reign are not of him alone. The Shevna's there for part of his reign. Va'av Ezra. What about the fact that Ezra, who's known as the Sofer, the great Talmud Chacham, Hava Nechemiah ben Chachalaya. You have Nechemiah at that time as well, who, again, is a peer to him in certain ways, and therefore, he's not alone with regards to having both political and Torah greatness in one. Amar Rav Acha Brei D'Rova, Af Ani Omer, Imot Rabbi, Vad Rav Ashi, Lo Matzino Torah Gdula B'Makom Echad. And now you start to see the pattern, right? So we have Moshe Rabbeinu, now we have Rabbi, and according to this member of Rav Acha Brei D'Rova, we say the same thing about Rav Ashi, who is the closer of the Gemara, the period of the Amoraim. And therefore you have here these individuals which are marking significant eras as well as changes in the dynamic of Torah Shebaal Peh. Moshe Rabbeinu, who brought us Torah Shebaal Peh. You have Rabbi, who closes the Mishnah, and Rav Ashi, who is the closing of the Gemara. Again, the Asot Hashem Heferu Torotecha. And Rav Ashi also holds this tremendous both political power as well as big Talmid Chacham, greatness in Torah. Velo, is that really true about Rav Ashi? Ba'ava Huna Bar Natan. Huna Bar Natan is around in the time of Rav Ashi, and he is a tremendous Talmud Chacham, who was the Rosh Kola. Shiny Huna Bar Natan, the Mikav Havikayif Leder Rav Ashi. Despite the fact that Huna Bar Natan was great, he still was subject to the rulings of Rav Ashi, or in the end, Rav Ashi's rule governed, and therefore, even though he was around, Rav Ashi still held both the political power as well as the Torah power consolidated in one and had tremendous greatness by which even someone like Humana Bar Natan was subject to the rulings of Rav Ashi. Cheresh Romeis Vinirmas. A Cheresh can interact through Rimiza. The way that Rashi describes it over here means that it's the moving of his hands, the moving of his eyes. He can use indications, even though he can't speak. He can use other methods of communication, and therefore he can be Romez and Nirmaz. He can speak through Remez, and he can receive information through being signed or indicated to, assuming here that a Cheresh is both a Enu Medaber v'Enu Shomeya. Ben Beter Omer Kufetz v'Nikpatz. Ben Beter says that he can jump. Now what that means, according to Rashi, is that this is a lower form of communication, which is Akimat Sfatayim. Not something as obvious as the movement of hands or the eyes, rather simply a moving of the lips, which is a less obvious type of indication. So Ben Beteira is Mekiel with regards to the Cheresh, that his communication can even be in this way. That's the way Rashi describes it. On the other hand, the Rambam in the Perusha Mishnayot over here says B'mentera omer, shemecho memkro b'mentaldim, enu klom ad shikabela davar, v'yeh b'rishuto, v'yitein gam ken de mishuhu mocher, v'lo taspik lo b'remiza bilvad. The Rambam says that b'mentera is holding him to a higher standard, and saying that it's only if kofetz. Kofetz here means that the object moves from this individual to the other party, or from the other party to him. The kvitza is not on him himself, but the object of the kvitza is the item that they are transacting with. And therefore, the Rambam believes that Ben Batera is holding him to a higher standard and saying he has to move the object between them. So it's obvious, not just through remiza, but that they actually transact. And then that's an indication of the will of the cheresh. B'mitaltalim. That's true in mitaltalim. Ha'pu'utot mekhan mekach u'memkaran menkar. Pu'utot, the youngsters, when they transact, both if they purchase or they sell, b'mitaltalim in non-real property, movable objects, then their sales or their transactions are real transactions. Machloket b'mitaltalin. The machloket here is in mitaltalin, aval b'gitin divrei hakol b'remiza. But when it comes to gitin, everybody agrees that, or divrei hakol b'remiza. So for Rashi, that means that gitin are held to a higher standard than mitaltalin, which is that only remiza works here. Even ben b'tero, who normally allows kfitza, will only allow remiza by gitin. On the other hand, for the Rambam, it's a kula, which is that by metaltalin, we demand that there be kvitza for ben b'teira, but diri akol by gitin, even remiza works for marrying or divorcing. It says, pshita, b'metaltalin tan. The Mishnah explicitly says, b'metaltalin, which would seem to limit ben b'teira's position to metaltalin, maldutema, af b'metaltalin. Also in Metaltalin, Kamash Malan, that's not the case. Now, for the Rambam, it's much easier to read this af b'metaltalin, because the Rambam sees ben b'teira as a chumra, as being a chumra here. So now, how you would read this is, kofetz v'nikbatz af b'metaltalin, also by Metaltalin. Meaning, I demand that by Gitin, and also I demand it by Metaltalin. According to Rashi, who says it's a kula, then it's hard to read it as af b'metaltalin. What means that, by Gitin it works to have the Kula, but af mitaltalin, also by mitaltalin, we're going to say there is a Kula. It's not as easy to read it according to Rashi. And so Rashi, to deal with that issue, says that the af b'mitaltalin, why would you believe that by Gitin there's more reason to say that you're being mekil, is because just like b'knisa, you can do it b'kvitza, so too b'yitziah, you can do it b'kvitza. Meaning just like he can marry her through a kvitza, so maybe you would think that's the dispensation to give a get, b'kvitza, but not by metaltalin. That's why we'd be more mekel b'gitin versus metaltalin. In the end, the Kamash Malan is no, that it's only by metaltalin, and it doesn't apply to gitin at all. And therefore, we'll see that Rashi says here, Kamash Malan, that we don't say that. Rashi says something very interesting. Rashi in Kamash Malan says, Rav Nachman metaltalin dafka nakat ben b'teira. V'lobi gitin ubehar karot, lobi remiza, v'lobi kfitza. Dacho mishum kdei chayav tikun rabbanan. We're going to see in a second why the rabbanan allowed it, but the way Rashi reads the Kamash Malan is that Ben Batera says nothing works by gitin. You would have thought apim et altalin, and in the end he says Kamash Malan that nothing works by gitin. So Rashi reads the Kamash Malan, no, that Ben Batera says this is true by metaltalin, and by gitin, nothing works. You can't do any of these items. And then the divrei hakol b'remiza is not necessarily true then according to Rashi for Gitin, because Ben Batera, according to this, doesn't think that remiza works by Gitin. Ika d'amrei, Amar Rav Nachman k'machloket b'metaltalin, kach machloket b'gitin. Rav Nachman suggests that this machloket persists into Gitin. V'anan b'metaltalin t'nan. Isn't it in our Mishnah it says metaltalin? Ema af b'metaltalin. Even by metaltalin, this works. So again, here, for Rashi, the afim metaltalin is much harder. Afim metaltalin, again, is that Ben Batero, who is mekil by gitin, also allows you to be mekil by metaltalin. Ha'pu'utot mechan mekach u'memkaram memkar b'metaltalin. V'ad kama. How old are pi'utot? Pi'utot refer to young children. The question is, what is the age of these children by which their transactions are considered to be transactions? Mechavi Rav Yehuda Rav Yitzchak Brei. Rav Yehuda points to his Rav Yitzchak, his son, Kvarshit, Kvarshav, like 6-7 years old. He showed him like 6 or 7, whether he was showing him by pointing to Rav Yitzchak before he was Rav Yitzchak, or whether he was telling him or indicating to him that it was like 6 or 7. It's not clear here from the word michave, which usually means to show. Rav Kahana Amar, Kvar Shev, Kvar Tamne, 7 or 8 years old. Vavzita Tana, Kvar Teisha, Kvar Eser. And our Breita says like 9 or 10, Velo Plige. They don't argue. Kochad v'chad l'fi chorfei. Really depends on the maturity of the child, the intellectual capabilities, the maturity of the child, when their transactions become transactions. All right, over here, the fact that they bring 2 ages in each case, is that just a way of speaking, 6, 7? Or is that because you have male and females? And we know that females always mature a year before males. And so maybe the duplication of the ages here is because one's for the female and one's for the male. And that's what they're indicating here. And in the end, when you say lo plige, basically what you're saying is that under the age of 6, there's nothing to discuss. There are no transactions. Above the age of 10, the default status is that the transactions are okay, unless we know otherwise. Between those ages, you need to check to understand if the child really understands what they're doing. Now, time am I. Why did they allow children to transact and to have binding transactions? In order that he should be able to take care of his basic necessities. So in these days where there are many times these children are left as orphans or taking care of the estate, so hopefully they appoint an executor to the estate. But if they don't appoint an executor to the estate, then the children need the ability to transact so that they can have food and they can have what to eat and they can provide for themselves. And so the Chachamim empowered them to have the ability to transact, even though they're only ktanim, in order to have those basic necessities taken care of. Some see the Kedei Chayav as a real limitation, which is that they're only allowed to transact for Kedei Chayav and exactly Kedei Chayav. On the other hand, the Ramban and others believe that Kedei Chayav is just the reason for it. But once we already matir them to transact, they can transact at whatever amounts or levels that they wish because they've given permission to act. Vayomer l'asher al amiltecha hutzei levush l'chol ovdei abal. So this is by Yehu, and he says to the person who's on the Miltecha, take out the clothing for all those that worship the Baal. When Yehu gets together all the worshippers of the Baal in order to kill them, brings them together into the Beit Knesset of the Baal, and he has them all put on the vestments of the Baal, in order that after they determine that there's no one who worships Hashem there, then they can take all these people and kill them because they are the worshippers of the Baal. And he's trying to rid Klal Yisrael of all this Avodah Zarah. And that's the context in which this Pasuk is said. My Miltecha. What is the reference over here? Rabbi Avraham ben Yaakov, Rabbi Yochanan, Davar HaNimlal VeNimtach. It is something that is both rolled and stretched out. They see the word as being a contraction of these two verbs. And the way that Rashi describes over here, we're talking about big day pishtan. We're talking about linen. Hein shechutan nimtach ayidei milila. The way that you make the string, you create the threads of pishtan is through rolling it in your fingers, back and forth in your fingers, till you draw the thread out of the pishtan. Shemoleu betzvutav shu toveh. That when you are spinning the pishtan to make it into a thread, you roll it between your fingers in order to create it. And then nimtach is that it is stretched out, it is made into a beged pishtan, benimtach means pulled out or strung out to make into a string. So it refers to big day pishtan. Whereas others suggest that the nimlal and nimtach over here is that nimlal is able to be rolled up and compacted, and nimtach can then be spread out afterwards, which we'll see has meaning in the remainder of the sugya. Kiata Rav Dimi, Am Rav Yochanan. So when Rav Yimi came, Rav Yochanan shigur lo bonium ben nunium barabi sivni b'chomps salsala umalmala. So these are items that were sent to Rabbi. Bonium ben nunium seems to be an extremely wealthy Jew. Based on his name, it sounds like he's somewhere probably from Greece or somewhere in the Asia Minor area. Here he's sending some sort of gift to Rabbi, who is the gadol ador to the yeshiva then. It's a practice that continues even into the time of the Geonim, that people from all over the world, or Jews from all over the world, used to send money to the major yeshivot, wherever they were stationed, in order to support yeshivot, or as gifts to the Roshe Yeshiva. So here they sends this gift to Rabbi, and these are the items that he sent. Sivnei v'chomes salsala umil malah. Whereas in the Gemara, in Eruvin, it's pronounced as bonius ben bonius, rather than bonium ben bonium. And there, the Gemara brings that, Rebbe hayimechabed ashirim. Rebbe used to give kavod the ashirim, which is premised on a belief that if someone is wealthy, then Hashem must be looking favorably upon that person, and there's a reason to be mechabed such an individual. But obviously you see here that there was a certain amount of mutuality to this, because not only did Rabbi give kavod to Ashirim, also the Ashir gave kavod to Rabbi and used to send him gifts. And there the Gemara relates that he sent his son probably to learn by Rabbi. Sivnei v'chomps ke'amguza upalgei d'amguza. Rashi describes over here, these are arba minim shobigdei pishtan. These are four different types of linen garments. Dak vitov, very thin and of excellent quality. So meaning these were expensive materials, and he sent them to Rabbi, whether it was clothing or just the base materials for him to make clothing out of, but he sent them these items. So now the first two, the sivne and the chomps, when they are rolled up, they roll up to the size of an amgoza upaged amgoza, 1.5 amgozot, which Rashi says here that the talit gedola, the midato, that this talit that he sent him, this clothing that he sent him was very large, but kushu mekapla lo hayatam yotermi egos vechetzi. When you rolled it up, because of the thinness of the material, you were able to compact it down to the size of a nut and a half. There are those that suggest over here that the egos that they're speaking about here is like the coconut, not a walnut, smaller nut, and it would make more sense. But either way, what the idea is that the quality and the fineness of the material was such that you could compact it to a very small size, and then afterwards you can expand it, and it was a large garment for Rabbi. Those were the first two, the Sivne and the Chomes. And then the Salsala Almala, Kepiskata upalge de piskata. The other materials, when you rolled them up or you compacted them, they had the size of a piskata. Rashi says it's a golnut, shochlim chazirim, feed for the pigs. Golnut, again, some sort of small item that they were using as the reference here. Some say that the pistaka is from the shoresh, from the pistachio nut. But it was 1.5 of those items. And again, here the Gemara is bringing down this because of my malmala. What is this malmala? Rabbi got davar nimlal v'nimtach. Again, the same definition that we saw before that was brought with regards to the story with Yehu, they're bringing over here as well, which is it's a davar nimlal v'nimtach, something that's rolled or rubbed between the fingers and then strung out. That's how you spin the pishtan to make it into thread. So that's what it's referencing over here. Where it says, v'ta utan ad kama. If the child transacts, and there's a mistake in the pricing of the transaction. Buyer paid too much, paid too little. There's a discrepancy between the market price and the price paid in this transaction. How much do we allow in terms of a skew off the market price and still consider it between in the normal range? Where it says, Amar Rav Yonah, Amar Rav Zera, ad shtut ki gadol. Same din as a gadol, which means up to 1/6. The same way by a gadol, that we say that up to 1/6 is considered not to be ona'ah. 1/6 is ona'ah and you return it, but this transaction stays in place. Anything over a sixth, then the transaction fails and you unwind the transaction, because up to a sixth is considered to be the normal margin that a person can take, or the normal discrepancy, a normal distribution over a market price. So bayabaye matanato mai. What about gifts? Over here you're talking about transactions, that the katan is allowed to make these transactions based on this takanat chachamim. Is he allowed to gift based on that? So Rav Yemer Amar ein matanato matana, that he's not allowed to gift. Mar bar Rav Ashi Amar matanato matana, that a gift is a good gift. Avchua v'shadrua the kamei de Rav Mordechai. They flipped the positions and sent this to Rav Mordechai to get his decision as to which is the proper way to follow. Now, Rashi over here says that they did this by mistake. Bnei Yeshiva Tov. They made a mistake over here. Rabbi Kiva Eger sends you to the Gemara in Kiddushin, Where over there, Rashi seems to indicate that they did it intentionally, that they switched it. And that's because Rav Mordechai is a Talmid of Rav Ashi. He's a student of Rav Ashi. And therefore they were afraid he was going to be biased and accept the position of Marba Rav Ashi because he's the son of his Rebbe. So they flipped the positions to ensure that there was no bias in Rav Mordechai's psak. Amalei Zilu Amru the Bar Mar. Go say to the son of Mar. Bar is the son, Mar. Mar is his Rebbe, Rav Ashi. So the son of Rav Ashi is actually Mar Bar Rav Ashi, which is actually the way that he's known in Shas, is Mar Bar Rav Ashi. Lav Hachi Abuvda. That's not what his father said. Ki Avakai, Mar, Chad Karei Ara, V'chad Karei Adarga. When Rav Ashi had 1 foot on the ground and 1 foot on the stairs, stairs here really means a ladder, which is the way up to the Aliyah where the Beit Midrash was. She had 1 foot on the ground, 1 foot on the ladder. From Ranan Lei, Matanato Mai, and I queried of him, what's the story with the Matana of a child? From Ralan, and he said to us, Matanato, Matana, that it is a Matana. So you see here that he got it right, I mean that he knew what the Mesorah was from Avashi, because his Mesorah matches what we have from Avashi in the first place, not the way that the Bnei Yeshiva flipped it, whether they did it intentionally or unintentionally. And so he answers them that it's Matanato, Matana, based on what he heard from Avashi. And then the Gemara says over here, Achat Matanat Shchimira, Achat Matanat Bari. He has the ability to execute a Matanat Shchimira, a Matanat Bari, Achat Matanat Meruba, Achat Matanat Muetet, whether it's a large gift or a small gift, meaning that his power to gift is full and that he's able to give it. Tosafot over here already asks, wait a minute, we're dealing with the child here in the end. How far does this go? So Tosafot over here says, Tosfot says, based on the language here, as well as the context, it's pretty clear that we're talking about a matana here. We're only talking about a matana of mitaltalim. We're not talking about matana of land. And what about the fact that the Gemara in Baba Batra says that a child under the age of 20 is not allowed to transact b'nichsei aviv, in the possessions of his father, meaning that we want them to be of a certain maturity and age before they start transacting in what let's say consider to be the base assets of the estate, which is the land, which is essential and the item that you don't want them selling. You have to wait till a much later date, till the age of 20. So then he says, so what you have to say is that there's different stages here. There's a stage when they're a katan. In the stage of katan, they're only allowed to transact in mitaltalin. And that means both in transactions as well as matanot. Under the age of 13, we allow them to do it because they chayav. The view here of matana is that matana is usually for a quid pro quo, which is people only gift if someone has done something good for them. So it's not like a transaction where there's exact value being exchanged for the object. But when someone is gifting, they're gifting because the other person is providing them with something. So therefore, according to this, the gift should be no different than mitaltalim. Tosafot then brings another stage. Between the age of 13 and 20, he can gift property, but he cannot transact in the estate or transact in the property. And then over the age of 20, he's allowed then to begin to transact in the estate. That which he can gift, or the fact that he can gift karka between the age of 13 and 20, and maybe according to some other Rishonim, unlike Tosafot, even younger than that age, might only be in property that he acquired or property that came to him through his work, not the property of the estate. And that's how other Rishonim differentiate between that Gemara in Baba Batra versus the Gemara over here, which seems to indicate that he might be able to do this earlier. And that has to do with whether the property is the property that he inherited through the estate or is it property that he generated through his own means or his own work. Maybe over there he could transact in that property at earlier times versus the property of the estate that he inherited, which we don't let him get into until the age of 20. And the Tosafot read over here qualifies the gifts and says, Amar Avraham lo shanu lo shein shem apichopus. V'yei shem apichopus emek chomekach v'emem kromemkar. Sham kadavti shigam matanato eno matana emyei shem apichopus. If there is an executor of the estate, then their transactions are null and void because they have someone to act on their behalf. And the same will be true with matanot, that they will not be permitted to give gifts if there's an apitropos, if there's an executor to the estate. On the other hand, there are those that believe since the apitropos himself cannot gift, therefore he doesn't govern the gifts of the tanim, and even though he nullifies their transactions, that would not be true by matanot, and they are allowed to give matanot even when there's an apitropus over the estate. All right, next Mishnah. Elu dvarim amru mipnei darchei shalom. So until now, the Mishnayot have spoken about tikkun olam. Now we move from tikkun olam to darchei shalom. Now, darchei shalom is really a subset of tikkun olam, because the reason that you do this is because of tikkun olam. That's why we want the darchei shalom. But darchei shalom, in one sense, is to prevent fighting. That's the key element of darchei shalom, is to avoid altercations. The tikkun olam that we've seen before are to provide in certain circumstances that, for instance, the young children could provide for themselves. So that's not to prevent fighting, it's simply to provide an ability for youngsters to transact so they can support themselves. So darchei shalom is a subset of tikkun olam, but in a narrower scope, which is it's trying to avoid altercations or fighting machloket. So here, the first of that is, kohen korer rishon, vacharav levi, vacharav Yisrael. That the way that we call people up to the Torah, the order is set, kohen first, levi second, Yisrael third, mipnei darchei shalom, for matters of keeping the peace, shalom leansuye, so that they don't come to fight about who goes first, who goes second, who's bigger, who's not bigger. This way it's defined, kohen, levi, Yisrael. First of all, it avoids some of the problem, doesn't avoid the problem entirely, because still within the class of Kohanim, you can still argue who's the first, who's the biggest Kohen in Levi and Yisrael. It happens to be that those fights go on as well. But at least this avoids the one who's first. And that we're going to see that the significance of being first is so great that they're going to fight about who is the biggest, who is the greatest. Over here, it really takes that out of the hands of that decision point and says, look, it's relegated to the Kohen. And since it's relegated to the Kohen, we don't have to make a decision. The Kohen's not necessarily going to be the greatest person here. And all of a sudden, you've taken some of that tension down already because there might be people greater than the Kohen in the shul, but the Kohen's going to get the aliyah because he's a Kohen. And even if there are multiple Kohenim and you're trying to decide between them, the issue is less pressured now because you've eliminated this idea that it's all about hierarchy because the greatest person's not getting the first aliyah. So by doing that, you've taken down the tensions and hopefully it will result in better outcomes than when you're trying to figure out from scratch who's the biggest person in the shul right now that we're going to give the first aliyah to. Ma'arvin bebayit yashan mipnei darchei shalom. We put an eruv into the old house, meaning the house that they've been putting the eruv in until now. They continue to put it there. We don't switch it, and the Gemara, again, we'll discuss this in tomorrow's daf. Bor shukarul ve'ama, the cistern. Bor in the Mishnah and the Gemara references to a cistern. A be'er is a well. So a bor, a cistern, has to be filled by diverting water or collecting rainwater. So over here they're speaking about filling the cisterns by using the irrigation channel that's coming off the river. So they had dug an irrigation channel off the river. The irrigation channel feeds numerous fields. It moves through different fields, and then the water is used by all the parties along the line. So this is the darchei shalom. The one who is karov li'ama mitmalei rishon mipnei darchei shalom. The one who's closest to the irrigation channel, or the first along the line of the channel off the river, he fills his cistern first. And then so on and so forth as you go down the line. Once you do that, you have to divert the water off the channel. That means anybody downstream of the channel is not going to get water during that period of time. So the right to fill your cistern starts with the one closest to the river, or the one at the beginning of the channel. And that's how they made darchei shalom, so that there's a set order about who fills their cisterns. Mitzudot chayav ofot v'dagim, yesh behem mishum gezel mipnei darchei shalom. Because of darchei shalom, we don't allow you to steal or take animals that are found in traps. We'll have to discuss, Gemara will discuss why there's no kinyan over here, or why it doesn't go into the private property of the individual. But assuming they're out in a public domain or public forest, and then it captures something, the fact that it's captured by this person's trap, somebody else comes by and says, oh, look at this, I'll take this. Why not? Because they don't have ownership over it. If they don't have ownership over it, or they don't have a kinyan over it, they're not wrong in doing that. But mipnei darchei shalom, they said, don't do that, because it's going to lead to fighting about whose is this, who took this. This way, if your trap works, then you take what's in your trap, and we don't fight over it. Rabbi Yossi Omer, gezel gamur. It was full-fledged gezel. The way that we'll see in the Gemara later on, gezel gamur over here is not that it is literally gezel de'oraita, but rather it is gezel gamur midrabanan. Not just mipnei darchei shalom, but it's deemed to be gezel midrabanan. Mitziat cheresh shote v'katan. A cheresh shote v'katan who find something, a mitziah. Again, these are not bnei dat. Since they're not bnei dat, you would think that maybe they don't have a kinyan here. Yesh ben mishum gezel mipnei darchei shalom. We don't allow you to grab it away from them or take it from them because of darchei shalom. Otherwise, anytime they find something, someone's going to jump on them and grab it away from them. People are going to fight over what they have. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Gezel Gamor. Rabbi Yossi again says, not B'nei Darchei Shalom, but it's real Gezel. Ani Aminakef Berosh HaZayit. So a Ani who is collecting his Matnot Aniyim off of the tree. So now the way Rashi describes Minakef is Chotech, he's cutting. The other way to explain Minakef is that he's banging, he's hitting the tree, he's shaking the tree, and the fruits are coming off the tree. So he's shaking away, and there's a guy standing underneath him with a bucket just going, hey, thank you, thank you, and he's going to lose out. So mipnei darchei shalom, they said, ma shetachtav gezel mipnei darchei shalom. Whatever falls under him from what he's cutting or what he's shaking belongs to him, mipnei darchei shalom. Not because he made a kinyan on it, not because he has, quote-unquote, any right to it, but if we don't do that, then you're always going to have this problem that one guy's going to stand below or people are going to take from those, and nobody's going to want to go up the tree because whoever's at the top is going to get nothing. So because of that, minei darchei shalom, they say if someone is the one who releases the fruit or gets the fruit, then they're his fruit because he worked on it. We do not reject non-Jewish aniim who come to collect from leket shichan peya because of darchei shalom. Right now we're going to deal with the first of the items that's mentioned in the Mishnah, which is how do we know that the Kohen goes first? Menahane mile. Amara matna damakra. The Pasuk says at the end of Sefer Devarim, Vayichtav Moshe at the Torah Zot, Vayitnai laKohanim b'nei Levi. He wrote the Torah and he gives it over to the Kohanim who are the children of Levi or from Shevet Levi. Atu anu yodano haKohanim b'nei Levi ninu. Isn't it obvious that Kohanim are from B'nai Levi? Because Kohanim are just a subset of Shevet Levi. So why do you have to tell me that they're the Kohanim B'nai Levi? Ella, Kohen Bereisha V'Hadar Levi. It's come to give you an indication of hierarchy, which is Kohanim first, and then Leviim second, and obviously then Yisrael would be third. Mitzvah Nafka Mar Miocha. Learn it out from here. B'nikshua Kohanim B'nai Levi. There's the description of the Mamad at Har Gizim and Har Eval. It says there that the Kohanim B'nai Levi will come. Atu Anan Lo Yadina, the Kohanim B'nai Levi Ninu. Same question. Don't we know that Kohanim are a subset of Leviim? The Kohen Bereisha of other Levi. Same Limut. Kohanim first and then Levi second. They're trying to show what is the source for the fact that Kohanim get precedence. Over here, according to the first two that we've seen so far, it seems to be that it's an asmachta, that the Pasuk indicates through its language, seems to give Kohanim precedence. It's not the simple pshat of the pasuk, but at least in making that, they have a seemingly an asmachta from this that is the case. Rav Ashi Mar Mehocha Bnei Amram Aaron uMoshe byabdel Aaron akdisho kodesh kodoshim from Divrei Yamim, which says that Bnei Amram, the children of Amram, Aaron and Moshe, and then between Aaron and Moshe, who are both Leviim, byabdel Aaron, he separated or segregated out Aaron akdisho kodesh kodoshim. To make him holy, holies, meaning that he is even a higher level than Moshe, who's just a Levi. So you have the Kohanim being designated or delineated for a higher level. And that we know also from Adat Korach, and we see other places the indication that the Kohanim are at a different level than the Leviim. So again here, an Asmachta, obviously if you bring it from Divrei Yamim, which are Tuvim, you're only talking about an Asmachta, the fact that Kohanim go before Leviim. Chia ba'aba amar mehocha. Chivava says from here, v'kidashto l'chol davar shebikdusha. Now here he brings a pasuk from Parshat Emor, says v'kidashto, that means that you have to make the Kohen holy. It's not simply that the Kohen is holy. V'kidashto means that you have an obligation to make him holy. How do you make a Kohen holy? Is that you grant him certain rights that indicate his position or his standing. Tana debei Rabbi Yishmael. So we have a Tana Debei Rabbi Yishmael, just a note, yesterday when we spoke about Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, that was brought by Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, who was a contemporary of Rabbi Akiva, that is the Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha of the Tana Debei Rabbi Yishmael. Whenever you see Tana Debei Rabbi Yishmael, it references that Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha. This connects back to what we had spoken about yesterday. That anything that involves kedusha, liftoach rishon, livarech rishon, litol maneh yafeh rishon, he has the right to open first, to make the bracha first, and to take the first portion. So the way Rashi describes that is liftoach rishon means b'chol davar kavod. Anything that involves kavod, something that involves honor or public issues, ben b'torah, ben b'yeshiva, hu yidaber b'rosh. Whether he is in Torah, or whether it's with a yeshiva, people are sitting together, he speaks first. I mean, any time there is deference given, the deference will be given to the Kohen. The Varech Rishon is Bisuda. Now that can reference different parts of Suda. Rashi most likely is referencing to Birkat HaMazon, to benching and leading the benching, but it could also involve making Kiddush. It could also involve making the Bracha Rishona when they made one Bracha Rishona for everybody at the table. All of these would indicate that you have to give deference to the Kohen. L'tol maneh yafeh rishon, Rashi over here believes, im bala chalok im Yisrael b'chol davar. It's coming to subdivide any object with Yisrael. L'achar sheyachloku b'shaveh, after they divide the portions up evenly, omer lor bror b'tul ezu shetirtzeh. You get to pick first. So the assumption is that everyone's a party to the division, and then the Kohen gets to pick first. The way that people do this with their children, when they're fighting over something, you let one child split it, then the other one pick which one they get. But the same idea here, the Kohen at the end is the one who gets to pick the splitting here. Tosfot over here says that that is not the case. It's not a broad imperative to always give the Kohen the right to take first. It has to do where the rights of the individuals are granted to them. And when granted rights, then the Kohen will go first. But if they are in a partnership together, then that's not the case. As Tosfot says, we go ma'maiser ani, o b'tztaka, imu ani, o b'chaverim ha'misubim b'suda, or friends that are together in a suda, then he gets to take first from the serving pot. All of these items he gets first because all of those are issues of deference, and where there's no agreed upon shtafut, it's an imposed relationship that they have. If they're in a regular business partnership, the Kohen has no more rights than anybody else. That's a financial partnership. That's not a partnership either because the Torah gives you a partnership in being aniyim together or accepting tzedakah together, or a partnership of friendship where deference would matter. So in all those cases, the Kohen gets precedence. But in a case of a financial transaction or in business dealings, the Kohen does not get first, according to the Balei HaTosafot. Rashi doesn't seem to make such a differentiation. He seems to indicate any time he's in a partnership with Israel or he's splitting with Israel, that the Kohen gets the right to make the first choice in that case. Tosfot says this because the Gemara in Pesachim says, that if a person always takes the best portion, he doesn't get bracha from it. So he sees it seems it wrong that the Kohen should always be the one who picks the best portion. And so the way that he deals with that issue is to split it between certain items where he does get that right, and other items where he doesn't get that right. Others just suggest that the Kohen has the right in all places. Doesn't mean he has to pick the maneh yafeh. Just because he picks first doesn't mean he has to pick the best one. He could pick first and pick not the best one, and therefore you'd solve that problem of that person who always picks the best doesn't see a siman bracha. So that's another way to deal with this. We had here four psukim that are brought. Two of them from the Torah, one from Divrei Yamim, and the last one from the Torah. In the first three cases, it's an interpretation, it is an exegesis on the Pasuk, it's not the Pshat of Pasuk. In the last one that we brought for sure, and you could argue maybe in the first two it's that way as well, there is an imperative that the Torah is saying, which is V'kidashto, which would indicate that it's a Torah mitzvah to do this, to designate and make sure that the Kohen is unique and treated with deference. If that's the case, you have the next question, which is Amarle Abaye the Rav Yosef. Abaye says to his Rebbe Rav Yosef, Mipnei Darchei Shalom. You're telling me this whole issue is Mipnei Darchei Shalom. De'oraita hi. It's a din de'oraita. You're quoting me psukim as the source. Amarle de'oraita Mipnei Darchei Shalom. Says you're right. It's a Torah law because of Darchei Shalom. The Torah made it this way so that there wouldn't be fighting. That is the result of the Torah law is that there is Darchei Shalom. Says Kol Torah Kula Nami Bnei Darchei Shalom He. That's the idea behind the whole Torah, which is Dichtiv Darchei Noam V'Chol Netivotah Shalom. When it talks about the Torah, Eitz Chaim Hi L'machazikim Ba, when you speak about the Torah, the way or the values of the Torah are that Darchei Darchei Noam B'chun Etivotei Shalom. The Gemara quotes this in numerous places with regards to determining whether a halacha should be this way or not be this way. And the Gemara will answer Darchei Darchei Noam. We had an example of that in Yevamot. When it comes to the case of a woman who was married to a man, they have children, and then she goes off after the death of her husband, gets married or does whatever she wants because she's not subject to Yibum, they have children, and then all the children pass away afterwards. And all the children pass away, the Gemara wants to know, shouldn't she have to do Yibum now because this individual passed away, lost all of his children, there's no shame left for him, that maybe she should have to do Yibum then. The Gemara answers, it can't be, Darchei Darchei Noam, that the ways of the Torah are pleasant, and there's no way that the Torah would make this, because it would leave an undue burden on this woman. First of all, she could never get married again then, because of the risk that the children might pass away. Or if she does get married, all of a sudden she's going to be pulled away from this new husband and then have to go now and perform Yibum or perform Chalitza. I mean, it would be an untenable situation. But the Gemara answers, the reason we don't do that is because Darchei Darchei Noam. That's the way of the Torah. The Torah seeks the pleasant and the way of Shalom, and that's inherent to the Dinei Midoraita. Why is it specific to this one particular din? It's about the whole Torah kula. El Amar Abaye LeKedemar. It's because of this. The Tanya. Shnaim Mamtinim Ze LeZe Bikara. Shlosha Ein Mamtinim. Two people wait for each other when it comes to the serving dish. Three don't wait for each other. So whether this is in a case where they are eating, and one of them stops to eat, does the other party have to stop to eat? So when there are two, if the other party stops to eat, then the other person is compelled to stop eating. And then when there are three, then that's not the case. I mean, if one stops, the other two can continue eating. That'd be one way. It's an etiquette issue. Or the other possibility is if you have two eating and one goes out of the meal, then the person who's left behind has to stop eating. Whereas if you have three people there and one person leaves, the other two can continue eating. Basically, this is etiquette with regards to the division of the food that's there. When there are two parties there, if one continues to eat while the other one is either stopped or gone out, then he's going to take more than his portion. When you have three already, we're not so exact about the portion distribution, and therefore people are more likely mochel on the exact amounts or quantity that each party eats, and therefore if one of them stops eating or one of them leaves, the other two can continue eating. Habutzeya hu poshet yado tchila, the one who breaks the bread gets to take first, meaning that he can take the bread and then dip it into the lefet first. If he chooses to, he can give deference to someone at the table, and even though he was the botzeya, he can give that right to his Rebbe or someone who's greater than him to go ahead and do the dipping into the lefet first. This is only true in a suda. In the shul, it's not that way. Because they're going to come to fight. So what you see here is, there's a certain amount of etiquette that is allowed in the suda. When it comes to meals in their day were a significant event, as well as there was a lot of protocol as to how they do that. You can remember from the Gemara in Brachot, as well as the Gemara in Pesachim, about Haseba, all these items that revolve around the meal, about how you started, who washed hands first, who got their table first, who begins to eat, who stops, where you're sitting in terms of the couches that are laid out, all of these mattered in their meals. Again, a lot of etiquette, a lot of protocol involved. So here, with regards to the meal, you're allowed to give deference to people, even though you have a right. Meaning that if you broke the bread, you technically are the leader of the meal, and you should be able to take first. Nevertheless, you're allowed to defer that to another party. What was being said here is amamar, that they qualify that statement, that's only true in a se'uda. When it comes to shul, you can't give that deference. Or in other words, if someone has entitlement, they can't then say, my Rebbe's here, I want my Rebbe to get the aliyah. So you have a Kohen who's entitled to the first aliyah, says, my Rebbe's here, give my Rebbe the aliyah. You're not allowed to do that in shul, the atele and suye, because then they're going to come to fight. Which is that in a suda, it's a smaller environment, and it's up to the individual if he wants to give deference, not the ones to give deference. In the shul, if there is this concept of deference, then they're going to again start fighting. Did he give deference? Should he give deference? Who should get it first? And you're back to square one. So what the Darchei Shalom is that they remind me the din al deoraita. That even though in the meals they allow you to, even if you're a Kohen, give it to your Rebbe. Nevertheless, in shul, they said you must stand by the din deoraita, and the Kohen must go first. despite the fact that you want to give kavod to someone else. We don't let you get, we don't give you that option anymore when it comes to shul, and that's what it means. Yes, it's a din d'oraita, but mipnei darchei shalom. So here in this Gemara's conclusion, this issue of giving it to the kohen first is a din d'oraita, and that is the conclusion of the Gemara. And Yerushalmi and in other places, the Gemara seems to indicate that this issue of kidashto might only be derabanan and not be d'oraita, but our Gemara is pretty clear that it is d'oraita. Amar Rav Matna, hadamar v'beit Knesset, that's what you say in Beit Knesset, lo, that you're not allowed to give deference. Lo amran elo b'shabbatot v'yamim tovim d'shchichei rabim. It's only true on Shabbat and Yom Tov, where there are large crowds in the shul, and therefore you're going to have all this fighting that goes on if you're going to give deference, if you're going to decide who's the best, who should, who shouldn't get it. And therefore they said, too bad, Kohen gets first, Levi second, Yisrael, and that's it. Aval b'sheni v'chamishi lo. On Mondays and Thursdays, that's not a problem. So the way that you would read this is that on Mondays and Thursdays, there weren't so many people in shul. Since there weren't so many people in shul, there's less reason to get into a fight. There's less issue about who should go first, who should go second. Tosfot Ariri over here says, Omer Rabbeinu Tam, Hani Mili Didhu. That's only going their time. Debechol Havutride B'melachtan V'lo Shchichei. They were so busy with their work that they didn't show up to shul on Mondays and Thursdays. He says, we get as big crowds on Monday and Thursday as we get on Yom Tov, which is pretty impressive. If they were getting on Monday and Thursdays the same crowds they got on Yom Tov, that was a pretty significant crowd. That means a lot, everybody was coming to Minyan. I don't know if today, if you could say it went back to the old ways, where on Mondays and Thursdays, you're not getting clearly the same crowd as you get on Yom Tov. Ini, is that true? Rav Huna, kari b'kohane b'shabbatot v'yomim tovim. Rav Huna, who's not a Kohen, was called up to the Aliyah of Kohen on Shabbat and Yom Tov. So forget about Sheni v'chamishi where it doesn't apply. It seems here it doesn't even apply on Shabbat and Yom Tov. They were calling up Rav Huna. Shiny Rav Huna. Rav Huna is different. Dafilu Rabbi Ami Rabbi Asi kane chashivi de'eretz Yisrael. Because even Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, who are Kohanim chashuvim of Eretz Yisrael, Mikaf Havu Kaifile. They were under his dominion, or meaning that they deferred to his psak halacha, or gave deference to him. Meaning that he was the uncontested Gadol Hador. So when you have that, when you have an uncontested Gadol Hador, then you don't have to worry about the Insuye, because it's clear that he is the Gadol Hador. And if you give him Kohen, then it wouldn't be a question of fighting. Everybody knows why he's getting the first Aliyah. Tosfot over here says, Mashma di lav hochi asur. If it wasn't for this fact that he was the uncontested gadol ador, it would be asur. Afilu hu gadol mikol bnei iro. Even if he is the uncontested gadol ha'ir, that's not enough. You need the gadol hador and not just the gadol ha'ir. And basically, what Tosfot does in this, you've limited or basically made it impossible almost to make this situation or replicate this situation. Because you have to find an uncontested Gadol Ador, which is unlikely or very rare. And therefore the case of Rav Huna is an exception to the rule rather than being the rule. And the Tosafot Reed says this even more explicitly, which is Perish V'Davka Gadol Ador, She'im B'chol HaMekamot Kemotu, Kulam Kifufim Tachtav, Ve'im Mishit Kanebo, V'maya Gadol B'Yiro B'Yovad, Eino Rashay Lachlok Lo Kovot, Dilma Atilin Suye. It's only true when he is the uncontested Gadol Ador. But when it comes to a Gadol in the city, they can end up fighting over it. And he gives you the psychology behind that is, Shrei Bnei Adam Mitkanim Vitovsim Atzman Kigdolim. People are jealous, and every person puts themselves up on a higher pedestal and always thinks that they are deserving of more kavod. And therefore, it will always end up in altercations or fighting when you're trying to figure out who is the greatest one in the community. The Rambam in the Perush of Mishnayot over here rails against the practice that we have today, and he says here, "Da shezeh davar mufusam b'chol makomot shehakohen kore b'beit knesset rishon." Everybody knows, and it's the wide practice that the kohen always gets the first aliyah in shul. Ben sheyeh tamid chacham or am aretz. Doesn't matter what the standing of this kohen is. Is he a tamid chacham? He's an am aretz. Hinehu davar she'ein lo shorish b'torah klal. There is no source for doing such a thing. V'lo niskar zeh b'shas, and it's never mentioned anywhere in the Gemara. V'lo hi zot ha-kanavna nirmezet elea b'zot ha-halacha. And that's not the intent of this halacha. V'ani nifla ha-pela u-pela מערי הגלות שנוהגים בזה המנהג אחרי היותם בריאים מחולאי המנהגות ומדעות האחרונים ודרכיהם, ואין אצלם אלא עניינים נאותים ללשון השס. And even these communities that are independent of all these influence of these bad minhagim, and all that they do is follow that which the Gemara says, nevertheless, they're still burdened by this problem, which is that they give the Kohen the first aliyah. Ve'enu yudeya me'ezim alkom balahem ze'a hefseid. I have no idea where this bad practice came about. V'amnam tzirat ha'inyan lefi ma shebalanu b'kabbalah, the way that the true Kabbalah is, k'mo shagid, וזה שכהן קודם לאביו לישראל לפי שנאמר וקידשתו, כי את לחם אלוקיך הוא אוכל, הוא בא בקבלה בכל דבר שבקדושה לפתוח ראשון, לברך ראשון, לטעום מנה יפה ראשון, וזה כולו בשאין שם חכם גדול ממנו. That's only true when there isn't a greater תלמיד חכם than the כהן. כגון שיש שם כהנים, כהן ולוי מישראל, יהיו כולם במדרגה אחת בחוכמה. As long as they're of equal stature in Torah, then the rule is Kohen, Levi, Yisrael. But he says, Aval, im hayam mamzer talmud chocham, b'kohen gadol, ama aretz, mamzer talmud chocham, kodem b'chol inyan. A mamzer talmud chocham precedes a Kohen, ama aretz. Mavur b'shas, it's explicit in the Gemara Megillah, in the Mishnayot, in Horiot, she'achad min ha'chachamim kara rishon b'shabbat b'sefer Torah. Rabbi Ami v'ramasi gadolim mikonei Eretz Yisrael yimutsuim sham, Vishayoter Chachamayam, Ravuna, our case over here. The Kachamru, Rav Kora Bikane. We also have that din that Rav was called up to the Aliyah of Kohen. Tolamar, Kara Rishon, Kamal Kohen. And so the Rambam here rails against the practice of giving the Kohanim despite them being Amay Aretz first. And he says that the Locha Mipia Gemara is, yes, Kohen gets first as long as he's equal to the Levi Israel. But if you have a Kohen Amaretz, or Kohen who's not on the level of another Talmud Chacham, the Talmud Chacham gets precedence, and he gets the Aliyah, the first Aliyah, not the Kohen. Here the Rambam takes a very strong stance against this, what the Balei Tosafot just said, which is the Balei Tosafot relegate this to those unique circumstances where you're talking about the Gadol Hador. But otherwise, that's not true. Rambam says this is day-to-day halacha. Anytime there's someone who knows more Torah in the shul, he should get the first aliyah and forget about this Kohen business. The Kohen business is only default when everybody's of equal stature. But if they're not equal stature, then Talmud Chacham goes first. So anyway, the Rambam takes a very strong stance. Despite that fact, the halacha and the practice is not that way, and that the practice is more along the lines of what the Balei Tosafot say over here, which is that the Talmud Chacham is only when it's unique, Gadol Hador, and even today that practice has fallen by the wayside, and because of the problem of determining who is, or who gets to determine who is the Gadol Hador, and therefore the practice is that we always give the Kohen first, then the Levi, then the Yisrael, irrespective of the Chokhmat Torah of the individuals involved. But you see the Rambam, and it's pretty true in the Gemara, it seems to be that Chokhmat Torah was primary vehicle for deciding hierarchy, and yet that's gone by the wayside, and all we do is Kohen, Levi, Yisrael today. Now the Gemara continues. These are the cases that always come up in Shul, which is Amar Abaye, Naktinan, we have a Misora Miavotenu, Ein Sham Kohen. If there's no Kohen there, Nitparda Achavila. The whole bundle is unwound. What that means is subject to a machloket. Rashi brings two interpretations. Tosafot brings a third interpretation. Rashi brings two interpretations from his Rebbeim. The first of which is Nifsaka Kesher Ibeda Levi Et Kvodo. The Levi is not allowed to be called up whatsoever. The Levi's position is only after Kohen. If there's no Kohen there, the Levi gets no Aliyah. He's blocked out completely. And that's what Rashi says from his Moriah Zakein Umori Rabbi Yitzchak Ben Yehuda Kach Sideh Rav Amram. Aval Mitamidei Mori Rabbi Yitzchak Alevi Shamati. He says, I heard from the Talmidim of my Rebbe Rabbi Yitzchak Alevi. So Rashi brings another possibility, which is whichever one you want to give. The Levi no longer gets any standing, and therefore you can call up Yisrael, then a Levi, Levi, then Yisrael. The order is broken completely, and therefore you don't have to give any deference to Levi. But then you can call up the Levi whenever you want along the way. On the other hand, Tosafot over here says, Rabbi Yitzchak and Rabbi Yehuda Mefresh to Kore Levi b'kamakom ha-ra'ui lo. Then you call up the Levi in the place that is ra'ui for him. Now what that means in the place that's ra'ui for him, does that mean he can only get Sheni? Or does that mean that the Levi, if you want, can get Rishon, but after that he can't get anything? But here you see three different interpretations, two in Rashi, one in Rashi that says he can't get any Aliyah, one in Rashi which says that he's no different than Israel, you can give him any Aliyah and he gets swapped out, and the Bali Atosavot to indicate that he only can get one Aliyah, the Makom HaRa'ui, look, whatever is Ra'ui for him. You can see in the Tosafot read, he writes, Nitpadar Chavila Perush, Lo Amrin in Yaktim Alevi L'Israel, Al Korim Lifi Malatan. You call them up according to their hierarchy, which again will be difficult and make it difficult to determine. But over here, he sounds like that interpretation of Rashi, which says that the Levi can be called up. He just doesn't have any precedence. He gets called up just like any Israel. You can call him up anywhere you want, as long as you're following some form of hierarchy. Generally, our practice is actually not to give the Levi any Aliyah in a case when there's no Kohen. And if you do give the Levi Aliyah, then we tend to give him the first Aliyah out of all. But we try not to do that because otherwise it seems to indicate that the necessity to give the Levi the first Aliyah when the Kohen's not there, and that's just not true. So we try to avoid doing that so that we don't set a precedent by which the Levi always gets it first when the Kohen is not there. And therefore the practice in most shuls is when there's no Kohen, they call up Yisraelim for the entirety of the Aliyah. We have in Misora, that's the way Rashi describes Misora by Abotenu, Ein Sham Levi Kore Kohen. There is no Levi, you call up a Kohen. Imi, can you do that? Can you call up a Kohen for Levi? V'amar Rabbi Yochanan Kohen Achar Kohen Lo Yikra. You're not allowed to call two Kohenim back to back. Mishum Gomo Shal Rishon. Because it'll cast aspersions on the first Kohen. Meaning that if you call up a second Kohen, it's as if the first Kohen really wasn't a Kohen, so you have to bring up another Kohen because you don't believe that the first one was a Kohen. Levi Acha Levi, you're not allowed to call up back-to-back Levim. Lo Yikra Mishum Gam Shnehem, because it might cast aspersions on both of them. Mara says, Ki Kamrinan, that din that Abaye brings is Ba'oto Kohen. It's the same Kohen. Meaning that if the Kohen gets an Aliyah, then there's no Levi, that Kohen, that same Kohen gets the next Aliyah. So then doesn't cast dispersions because he's getting the next Aliyah. What you can't do is call up another Kohen for Levi. You have to call up the same Kohen. Tosafot over here notes that this is only true in our day. In our day where we make a bracha on every Aliyah, then you call up the Kohen for Kohen, and then you call up the Kohen for Levi. Distinguishing between the two of them is the fact that he makes brachot twice. But in the practice of the Gemara, where they only made a bracha rishona for the first Aliyah, bracha achrona for the last Aliyah, and every Aliyah in between, there was no brachot, then how do you call up the same Kohen for Kohen and for Levi? There's nothing that distinguishes his first Aliyah from his second Aliyah. So Tosafot over here suggests that what he has to do is, he has to sit down. That the Kohen has to go sit down in between his first Aliyah and his second Aliyah, and then get up again and come up for a second Aliyah, in order to indicate that there was a break, or there was a separate Aliyah for this Kohen. Again, today, that's not a problem for us, because we make a separate bracha of the Aliyah. But he says in time of the Gemara where they didn't, the Kohen would have to sit down in between the Aliyot, and then come back up again for the Levi Aliyah. The Gemara says, Maishna Levi Achar Levi. Why does the Braita that we just quoted over here, when it talks about a Levi after a Levi, it says, De'ikap gam shnehem. It says both of them might have aspersions cast on them if they bring up a Levi Achar Levi. Damri chad minayu, lav Levi hu. Because we're going to say one of them is not a Levi. Kohen achar Kohen nami. So why don't you say the same thing about the Kohen after Kohen? Amre chad minayu, lav Kohenu. You'll say that one of them is not a Kohen. If you look carefully at the Braita, it says we don't call up a Kohen after a Kohen because it might cast aspersions on the first Kohen. When it says Levi Achar Levi, it says it's going to cast aspersions on both of them. Why is there a difference by Levi versus Kohen? Where it says, Kugon the Muksak Lan Bavua Dai Sheni Kohen Hu. No, it's a case where we know the second guy we called up is clearly a Kohen because his father's a Kohen, and we know that he's a Kohen for sure. So where it says, you can make the case the same by Levi. Akhnachni, the Muksak Lan Bavua Dai Sheni Levi Hu. Can create the same case by Levi Acha Levi, where we know for sure that the second Levi is a Levi, and then why would it cast aspersions on him and not just on the first Levi? Ela Amrei Mamzeret Onitina Nosiv Upasle. We're going to say that maybe the Levi married a Mamzeret or a Nitina, but Upasle is Zare, and therefore his descendants are no longer Levim. They become, whether over here, if Mamzer Nitina, they have a status of Mamzerim or a regular Israel. So Achanami can say the same thing by the Kohen. Amrei Grusha Chalutza Nasiv. That he married a grusha ve'chalutza, and therefore he is no longer a Kohen. The children are born from that illegal marriage are chalalim, and they don't have a status of a Kohen. Va'achle de zarei, and he'll ruin his offspring, meaning that whatever scenario you can create by Levi, you can create by Kohen, or whatever by Kohen, you can create by Levi. Why should there be a difference between Kohen achar Kohen versus Levi achar Levi? So, sof, Levi, mikavi. My answer is no. It's different. In the end, is he a Levi? So what the answer of the Gemara is that in both instances, where there's an illegal marriage, and the Levi married someone he shouldn't, the children that are born are not Levim. A Kohen marries someone he's not supposed to, the children are not Kohanim. Not only are they not Kohanim, they're not Levim as well, they're just plain Yisraelim. And so the difference between a Kohen Achar Kohen and Levi Achar Levi is, who's the next Aliyah? When you call up a Kohen Achar Kohen, then if the first one was a Kohen, then the second one is a Levi. If the second one is a Levi, then the Kohen that you called up, if there was something wrong with him, forget about him being called up for Kohen, he couldn't be called up for Levi as well. He could only be called up for Yisrael. The fact that you're already calling up as the second Aliyah means he's either a Kohen or a Levi, but he can't be a Levi, so he's a Kohen. So he must be a Kohen, because if he did something wrong, or his parents did something wrong, and he's not a Kohen, then he wouldn't be entitled to Levi either. He wouldn't be entitled to any Aliyah except for Yisrael. The fact that you're calling up in the second slot already indicates that he must be a Kohen. And therefore, the only problem is casting aspersions on the first individual who was called up as a Kohen. On the other hand, when you have Levi, Acha Levi, the second Levi is called up for the Aliyah of Yisrael. So the second Aliyah is not determinant. So if you say the second Levi is also not a Levi, that's right, because he was called up for Yisrael. Therefore, it casts aspersions on both of them, because it's not clear which one of them is a Levi or not. You can say the first one is a Levi, the second one's a Yisrael, because he was a Levi, parents' father was a Levi, but he did something wrong, and now his children are not Levim. Or you could say, the first guy wasn't a good Levi, and that's why they had to call up another Levi to back him out. And then for that reason, you could cast dispersions on both of them by the Levi, because the next Aliyah is Yisrael, which would not indicate anything about their standing versus by the Kohanim. The Kohen Achar Kohen, when you give him the second Aliyah, then for sure he's a Kohen, because otherwise you wouldn't call him up for any Aliyah. Not for Kohen, not for Levi, except for Yisrael. And that's why there's a difference in how people will view Kohen Achar Kohen versus Levi Achar Levi. Gemara says, Uleman, who are we worried about over here? When you call up the Kohen Achar Kohen or Levi Achar Levi, what are we worried about over here? Ile Yoshvim, Hako Chazule. If the people are there that are staying in Shul, they can see it. Meaning that you have to call up 7 Aliyot on Shabbat, 3 Aliyot during the week, and they'll see that he's counted amongst the 7 that are called up. So even if you call up a Kohen Achar Kohen, if they only give out 7 Aliyot, it'll be clear that the first Kohen was coming up for Kohen, the second Kohen was coming up for Levi, and there won't be any problem. Ella, the takana here is the yotzim, is for those that leave shul. The problem is that there'll be people who leave shul, and they will not be able to see that there were 7 aliyot, or that they didn't repeat, they didn't give another aliyah out because of that problem, and therefore they won't know whether the reason the second Kohen came up was because the first Kohen was no good, or the reason that he came up is because there was no Levi here, and they won't know. And because they don't know, then they'll assume that there's something wrong with the first Kohen. So it's for the people who leave Shul that will cast aspersions on the first Kohen. So for that reason, we say only call up the same Kohen for Levi. Don't call up a different Kohen for Levi. Now the truth is you could have figured it out, even for the Yotzim, from what they laned. If the first Kohen laned something, and then they call up the second Kohen, and they continue to lane from where they left off, then it's clear that the second Kohen is not coming to replace the first Kohen, he's coming to be Levi. Otherwise, they would have started from the beginning again. So the answer to that might be in places where we read the same thing over and over again. For instance, on Chol HaMoed Sukkot, or in Chanukah, where we're reading the same Aliyot over and over again. In those cases, it's not clear because the second Aliyah reads the same thing that the first Aliyah reads. And since that's the case, you wouldn't be determinant just because of the difference of the reading. And that's why, again, you only call up the same Kohen. You don't call up a different Kohen, Bimkom Levi, when there is no Levi there. Tosafot over here knows something interesting. He says, Umisham Rabbeinu Yehuda Katvu, Dimein Bekneset Rak Kohanim. What happens if you have a Beit Knesset that's all Kohanim? What do you do in terms of the Aliyot? He says here, Achad Koreb Bimakom Shiva, V'Kol Parsha Yivarech Lefanei Achara. One Kohen gets the Aliyah, and he makes the bracha 7 times. He gets all 7 aliyot. Because otherwise it'll cast dispersion on the Kohen. So he comes up, he gets Kohen, gets Levi, and then he gets all the Yisraelim after that. One Kohen is called up, and he gets all the aliyot in a shul that is completely Kohanim. Very interesting case, and interesting how he deals with it, which is that in a shul of all Kohanim, you have to give that one person who gets the first aliyah of Kohen, which he's entitled to, You have to give him the remaining aliyahs so it doesn't cast dispersions on his first aliyot or the earlier aliyot that he got. And it's not enough that he just gets Levi. He has to get all the Israelim afterwards, and then he'll get all seven aliyot when he's called up to be the Kohen. Okay, we'll stop over here on the last line of Ayin Tet Amud Bet.